as an introduction, I want to start by just giving us a bit of a reality check. So I'm really aware that the last time I gave a talk was on Parinirvana Day, which was on the 16th of February this year. I know that some of you were there. We were at the Buddhist Center. Remember that place? Remember the shrine room and the light that comes through that lantern in the ceiling and through the windows? And we had a pretty full shrine room that day. We also had a shared lunch. Remember those? And there were also Mitra ceremonies. And that was less than 5 months ago. And it's almost unimaginable now, isn't it? Or it's almost unimaginable to me. I was watching a film on the telly the other night, which involved people eating in a small restaurant, elbow to elbow. And my immediate response was, that's not right. Because I, and perhaps all of us, have become so used to this new reality. It seems extraordinary that people did things like that. And so many things that were right and normal and were for such a long time, maybe the whole of our lives, no longer seem to be right or normal. And we don't know when they'll feel normal again. So anyway, this is me just reflecting on the fact of how much our overall worlds and each of our individual worlds have changed in this last 5 months. And another example is, here we are on Zoom. I imagine many of us didn't even know what Zoom was 5 months ago, never mind it becoming the main source of contact with others for many of us. And of course also, millions of people have got ill since the 16th of February. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. And perhaps millions of others will get ill, and perhaps hundreds of thousands of other people will die over the next year. And of course, people are always getting ill and dying, but these are additional illnesses. These are additional deaths. And I'm really aware that millions of individuals and families are having to cope with loss and are grieving at this moment in time. At this moment in time, when it's harder to give and receive comfort, it's harder to ceremoniously take leave of loved ones than at any other time it's been in a long time. And I'd like us to bear those people in mind this morning. And also I want to say that some of those people are us here today, have had those experiences. So I want to extend my metta to you in your time of difficulty. If you've been ill, or if you've had ill loved ones who've been ill or died, or if you're struggling or suffering in any other way, and I'd like us to extend our metta to each other in this way. We're also at a time when there's been a groundswell of redoubled awareness of prejudice and discrimination and its effects. And there's been a rising inspiration to change this. And as practitioners, those of us, you know, inspired by meditation, or some of us might call ourselves Buddhists, there may be many ways we feel like we want to respond to the suffering in the world, also to prejudice and discrimination that, in a way, we've been able to see more clearly, perhaps, in these last few weeks. And all I want to say here is that a heart and a mind filled with metta has no room for prejudice in it. And cultivating metta and acting out of metta is one thing that we can offer ourselves and others and the world that we live in. There may be many other ways we want to respond. I'm not saying metta is a universal panacea, but metta, a heart and mind filled with metta, has no room for prejudice in it. So I've said all those things as a way of clocking, really, that our world is changing, and what's more, our world has changed. And I kind of wanted to remind us of this, and me of this, not least because it's easy to forget these things in some ways. And I think it's important to remember, because remembering these things can give us an occasion to practice kindness. to practice compassion towards ourselves and others in what for many people is a difficult time. So that's how I wanted to just start the talk. Next, I want to move on to reading you a poem. You won't be surprised by that, most of you. But I want to read you a poem by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. And he's one of my favourite poets. And a bit like I was saying about the talk overall, you don't need to kind of try and nut out the poem with your head. You don't need to understand it with your head. But try and feel its energy and its intention. And it's got quite a lot of openness and freedom in it. So let the poem take you somewhere. And it's called Too Many Names. Mondays are meshed with Tuesdays, and the whole week with the whole year. Time cannot be cut with your exhausted scissors, and all the names of the day are washed out by the waters of night. No one can claim the name of Pedro. Nobody is Rosa or Maria. All of us are dust or sand. All of us are rain under rain. They've spoken to me of Venezuelas, of Chiles and Paraguays. I have no idea what they are saying. I know only the skin of the earth, and I know it has no name. When I lived amongst the roots, they pleased me more than flowers did, and when I spoke to a stone, it rang like a bell. It is so long, the spring, which goes on all winter. Time lost its shoes. A year lasts 4 centuries. When I sleep every night, what am I called or not called? And when I wake, who am I if I was not I? While I slept. This means to say that scarcely have we landed into this life than we come as if newborn. Let us not fill our mouths with so many faltering names, with so many sad formalities, with so many pompous letters, with so much of yours and mine, with so many signing of papers. I have a mind to confuse things, unite them, make them newborn, mix them up, undress them, until all the light in the world has the oneness of the ocean, a generous, vast wholeness, a crackling, living fragrance. So I'll let the poem sit there and hover above this talk. And I won't say anything more about it just now, other than to say I think of it as an alternative heart sutra. As some of you know, Kathy, my wife and I, live with our 11-year-old twins in Ringmer. And over the past 5 months, we've all had more to do with each other than we normally had before. And that was already quite a lot. And this has presented both challenges and opportunities. And I'm sure it's been the case for all of us, whatever our domestic situations were and now are, that there have been challenges on one hand and opportunities on the other hand. And one of the opportunities that Kathy and I have taken is to go off for a walk around the village at least a few times a week. And what we've most talked about has been, not surprisingly, the pandemic situation. We've tried to digest it, we've tried to understand it, we've tried to absorb it, and we've tried to get our heads and our hearts around it, perhaps like all of us have been trying to do. And there was one morning, probably about a couple of months ago, one early morning, because we often go for a walk at 7:30, and as we were walking down Moor Lane with the Downs and Firl Beacon opening up in front of us, very beautiful in the sunlight, Kathy said something like, "It's all just gone, hasn't it?" And I said, "It's like a lightning flash." And she said, "Yeah." And then I said, "It's like a bubble that's burst." And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Like it was a dream, that world we used to live in, with its givens and its certainties. And now it's like we're in a totally different dream." And she said, yeah, yeah, like that. I do need to point out at this point that she doesn't always agree with me, so don't get the wrong impression. But on this occasion, she did. And some of you will have worked this out already, but these metaphors, these images, come from a verse that's at the end of the Diamond Sutra. So the image of lightning came to me spontaneously when we were talking, but then I remembered those, the images of the bubble and the dream, so I brought those into our conversation. And the Diamond Sutra is a key Mahayana sutra, and it's held up especially in Zen Buddhism. It's one of the perfection of wisdom texts, which vary from very short to very long explorations of the same area of Dharma. And the one best known in Triratna, the perfection of wisdom text best known in Triratna, is the Heart Sutra. And I just want to share, I'm going to share my screen and show you a picture, which is of... it's not essential, so if you're chilling, don't feel like you need to see it. But you should be able to see, those of you who can see a screen, this is the cover of a Perfection of Wisdom text, and it's blood red. It's very emotionally vivid as a cover. It's a medieval, I think Tibetan cover. And at the centre of it is Prajnaparamita in the middle. And Prajnaparamita is known as the mother of all the Buddhas, in some contexts, and she, in a way, stands behind and above and under the Perfection of Wisdom text. She's the source of the Perfection of Wisdom. She's also the source of all the Buddhas. She's the mother of all the Buddhas. And her representation is not often as a kind of a, you know, 16-year-old, as often Indo-Tibetan Buddhas are. She's often portrayed as a mature woman capable of giving birth. So there's a sort of maturity of wisdom that Prajnaparamita has. And I just wanted to show you her there. She might come back, but I wanted to show you her. And in that verse that I was talking about, that is at the end of the Diamond Sutra, one of the translations goes like this: like stars, like a fault of vision, like a lamp, like a mock show, like drops of dew, like a bubble or a dream, like a flash of lightning or like a cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. And I suppose what struck Kathy and I when we were on this walk, that these changes that have happened in our world, this shift in viral threat, this vast number of deaths and serious illness in our country and in the world, the huge shift in the world's economic focus and economic expectation, the change in society as a whole, both outer and inner, and when I say inner, I mean people's psyches, people's psychologies, people's awareness, all those changes, it's been so huge that it's actually much easier to understand that Diamond Sutra verse, because it is as if we're in a different dream, because everything's changed. You know, things that we thought would last forever have changed, maybe forever, who knows. Some things have evaporated like dew. Some things have popped like bubbles. Some things have just become exhausted, like a lamp. When it says a lamp, it's referring to a spirit lamp which has fuel. You know, when the fuel runs out, the lamp just stops. So, you know, like a lamp being extinguished, some things have stopped. Some things have faded, like the stars. You know, in the night, the stars on a clear night anyway are so bright and sharp. But then when the sun comes up, where are they? So some things have faded like stars. So the rug has, as you can tell, I'm giving you lots of images here, but the rug has in many senses, and differently for different individuals and to different extents for different individuals, the rug has been pulled from under us. And recognising this led me to kind of feel and imagine my way back to the time of the Buddha. You know, that time that I was referring to 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha woke up under that tree at Uruvela and he walked the 40, 50 miles or so to Sarnath, and he shared the teaching, which is what Dharma Day is about. And I think that we're much closer to the time of the Buddha now than we have been in the West. We are certain of much less. And we're also having to look at the fact that we're not in as much control of the world as we thought we were. We've had to recognise that we're part of nature. We're not in control of it. Us humans, humans. And our world is less upholstered. Our world is more existentially bony than it was. You know, we've not got the kind of a comfort of a well-upholstered seat to sit on. It feels a bit more bony. And us humans, it's clear that we don't have dominion over the world. We can't control some of the most important things in the world. And this is how it was in the time of the Buddha. And it's also worth recognising that this is how it is and how it has always been in many societies and countries in the world that don't have the resources to protect themselves from nature, whether that's excessive heat or cold or flooding or illness or whatever it is. Actually, we're very few as people who have such an upholstered life, as it were, where we can control so much and have the fantasy of ultimate control. And yet, despite this threat and this boniness, this vast interruption that we've all had, it might be that this time, where we are now, each of us, in our rooms and our lives, for some of us at least, it might be a time where we can practice more fully. And it might be that you're even aware of this, even in the hairiness of this current situation. I was saying in a meditation that I led on Friday, one of the things that's going on for me at the moment is that I have a sense of dread. And it's so kind of deep that I'm largely not aware of it. But it's not anxiety. Dread is a better word. And it's because I don't know how things are going to be going forwards, you know, and I'm not comfortable with that sense of dread. And at the same time, I'm aware I'm practicing in a way that I haven't been before. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about Perfection of Wisdom texts. I find that the Heart Sutra, which is the Perfection of Wisdom text I know the best, I find it very inspiring. I've led retreats on it here and in the Americas. I learned the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit, and it's something that I enjoy chanting. In a way, I'm very connected with the Heart Sutra. And in the Heart Sutra, as many of you know, there is a Bodhisattva. And what happens in the Heart Sutra is we hear of what happens in this Bodhisattva's meditation. We share in his deep perspective, born of profound meditation. He tells us about it. He talks to us. Well, actually, he talks to Shariputra, who's one of the Buddha's main disciples. And he talks in a language that Shariputra can understand. And in a way, what he does is he proves to Shariputra that he understands his world by talking in all these concepts and ideas of Hinayana Buddhism. He talks about them exhaustively. And then he says, they're not the Dharma, they're not reality. And actually, you could say that the Bodhisattva of compassion, who's meditating and who's talking to us, he's talking to the Shariputra in all of us, you could say. And what he sees and what he tells us is that things are not quite as they superficially seem. Things that seem solid are less substantial and they're less enduring than we might prefer. This includes the body, and it also includes the mind. And the Bodhisattva of compassion sees these things are open. He sees that they're always changing. They're in process. They both affect and are affected by what's around them. He sees that the body and the mind are deeply connected and embedded in what's around them, existing in a web of causes and conditions, even inseparable from those causes and conditions. And this deep realization, this aligning himself you could say intellectually, but particularly emotionally and spiritually, with the truth of the body and the mind and the world, means that he is freed. He no longer hankers and clings to this or that thing, as he realises there's not a separate self that needs to pull or push. There's no separate self to be threatened. There's no separate self to try and enhance itself. He realises that these things won't anchor him or shore him up because they're ephemeral, like stars or a fault of vision or a lamp or a mock show or dewdrops or a bubble or like a dream or a lightning flash or a cloud. And I just want to reiterate that he's saying they're like this. He's not saying they are this. So they're metaphors. And Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is at peace and full of the dynamism and energy of seeing things truly. His misperceptions, his wrong views that have led to him being suffering and constrained are righted. And I want to read you a non-technical, shorter version of the Heart Sutra, which I've been playing around with as a way of sort of evoking some of the qualities of it. The Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the openness of heart, mind and body and freed himself from suffering. He said, "From here, it's clear to me my body and all material things are open, shifting. What's more, openness is the same as my body. And the heart-mind, with its feeling, perceiving, impulses and consciousness, it's the same too. It's open. It's free. In fact, everything is wide open, including the senses, sensing, and the sensing mind. There are no habits. There's no suffering or its cause. There's no freedom or its cause. There's not even wisdom or getting it. Even that's wide open. Holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in this deep wisdom, he's freed of delusive hindrances, freed of the fear bred by them, and reaches clearest nirvana." And this realization in the sutra, when the Bodhisattva of compassion starts speaking to us, it says, "Here then." In the Sanskrit, it's Iha Shariputra. So Avalokiteshvara is saying, Iha Shariputra is saying, "From here, Shariputra, from this place." So I'm really interested, where is this here? And how do you get to it? Because I think it sounds quite good. I like the idea of being free of constraining habits and limiting views, particularly because I know I've got them. And the things that lead to my own suffering because I'm holding on to them too tight, my hankering, my denying, my pushing away, my clinging. So where is this place? But I have a concern because at the moment, as we know, travel is restricted. So I'm a bit concerned we might not be able to get to that place. You know, there are lots of measures stopping us from going to places. But as it is, we are very lucky because this place does not require an air bridge or a risk assessment. To get to it, it does not require a relaxation of any quarantine measures. This place, the here then, of the Heart Sutra, the place Avalokiteshvara speaks from deep in meditation, is right under our noses. So as it says on those map boards, you know, can you remember when you used to go to parks and look on map boards? You often see there's an arrow which says you are here, doesn't it? Well, you are here. That is the here, where you are. And who is it also that gets there in the sutra, that's talking to us, who is freed? Well, it's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And I think that this, which in a way we could overlook, gives us a big clue. What it tells us is that this place where we can come and do some clear seeing and free ourselves is a place of compassion. We can only be there if we see with the eyes of compassion. So you could say that the Heart Sutra is an exploration of the three lakshanas, or marks of how things are, and in a way is a kind of a classic bit of Dharma that many of you will be familiar with. And also the images in the verse, the Diamond Sutra images, they're an exploration of the three lakshanas. So, in summary, people and things are impermanent. They change. They're always in process. They're never done. There's never a finished end to them. That's lakshana number one. Lakshana number two, people and also things are insubstantial. They're interdependent and interconnected. They both affect and are affected by what's around them. They're open, not closed. Lakshana number two. And lakshana number three is that people suffer to the extent that they don't align themselves with the above two truths. To the extent that they hold on to things too tightly, including their self, hold them with wanting, hankering, clinging, they suffer. That's what the three lakshanas are. Nagarjuna, who's sometimes spoken of as the second Buddha, said that the lakshanas and emptiness, or shunyata, as the translation, which is a emptiness is a translation of, he said that they need to be grasped correctly for them to do spiritual work. And what Nagarjuna said was, he compared getting hold of the lakshanas as picking up a poisonous snake. So if you imagine a snake that's got three spots on its head, you can imagine those being the three lakshanas. And what he said was that you just like to pick up a poisonous snake without being bitten by it. I know that some of you will have poisonous snake picking up skills, so you'll know more than I do. But in order to pick up a poisonous snake, if you pick it up by the tail, it will bite you. If you pick it up by the head, it won't bite you. And what Nagarjuna uses this image as a way of saying, we need to be able to hold the lakshanas in a way that is fitting for them to be of spiritual benefit. And I think that they need to be picked up by the hand of compassion. And if not, the lakshanas can seem quite nihilistic. And certainly our response to the lakshanas can seem quite nihilistic. And I think similarly, at this time, and perhaps this is particularly fitting giving this talk today, because it was Silly Saturday yesterday, wasn't it? And lots of people went out and got plastered in pubs. So there'll be a lot of hangovers in this world. But in a way, our response to threat, to pandemic, to difficulty, can sometimes be quite nihilistic. You know, we think, what's the point? Let us eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's the classic nihilistic, hedonistic response. And that wouldn't serve as well if that's what the lakshanas did to us, if we were not looking with the eyes of compassion. And just to say that if we are able to pick up the lakshanas, they will serve as well. And Avalokiteshvara is famed for having not just one hand, but 1,000 hands. And our hands can be the hands of compassion, with which we grasp wisdom, and also with which we go out to ourselves and others. And if we're inspired by the prospect of being a hand of Avalokiteshvara, the order, the Triratna Buddhist order, has the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara almost as its symbol. But whoever you are, whether you've got a Buddhist name or not, whether you're ordained or not, you can choose to be one of the hands of Avalokiteshvara. And this wisdom is about clinging on too tightly to nothing. It's about not getting caught up in details, or in the details of froth on the surface of life. Not getting caught up in the melodrama of our own life. Not getting distracted by how we want things to be or don't want other things to be. And perhaps in lockdown, we've not been able to get the same shampoo, or get our hair cut, or get the right flower. This is my confession here. I've had a bit of a thing about getting the right flower at points in the lockdown, and particularly yeast. I ran out of yeast, you know, and you would think for about 20 minutes that it was the end of the world, but of course it wasn't. And what these lacks may have done is that they may have loosened us to our preferences a bit, and we might have seen what we need as opposed to what we want. And sometimes we can think that our wants are our needs, and they're not. Those are different things. And it might have made us realise we're much more than our needs. We may have seen more fully what's important to us. This period may have given us space to move towards what's important to us as well. And we may have found that we have deeper experience and perhaps even deeper resources than we saw, than we may have thought we had. The Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra has some great illustrations of people being a bit caught up in the froth of life and not attending to the substance. And there's a famous encounter between Vimalakirti and Shariputra, who in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara is talking to. And Vimalakirti is a householder, he's not a monk, but nevertheless, he gives the monks and some of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, he really gives them a run for their money. And famously, Shariputra, we're aware that, so Vimalakirti is giving a teaching in his house, and it's quite small, and hundreds of thousands of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are about to come to his house. And Shariputra, who is a bit of a comedic figure at this point, is really fretting about if there'll be enough chairs for all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to sit on. The householder Vimalakirti says is, do you come here for the Dharma or do you come here for the chairs? Or paraphrasing it a little bit, he says that to Shariputra. And I think in my life and in our lives, maybe we do spend too much time worrying about the chairs and not engaging with the Dharma. And it's a Buddhist joke that does help us see how some of our preoccupations are frankly ridiculous. But the truth is that it's not that there are 10,000 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas about to arrive in your house where you are now. They're actually there. Let me tell you, there are 10,000 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in your house. And in a way, what I want to ask you, and is something that you can talk about in the groups that we'll have shortly, what are you inspired to give attention to with the knowledge that there are 10,000 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in your house? And also, given that there are 10,000 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in your house, I know because I ordered them all on eBay, so they should have arrived. Also, what can you let go of? With the knowledge that there are all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in your house, what are you inspired to give attention to and what can you let go of? Vimalakirti then goes on to say, after he said this to Shariputra, he said, you know, are you bothered about, you know, what's on sale at Habitat or the Dharma? He then speaks a verse and Vimalakirti says this, the body is inert like the earth. The body is selfless like water. The body is impersonal like the wind. The body is insubstantial like space. The body is unreal, being a collection of the four elements. It is void, indefinable, mysterious. And I think what Vimalakirti is trying to do in that sutra and in that communication, and also what the Heart Sutra is inviting us to do, is to recognise that we don't have it all nailed down. There is a rich and beautiful mystery in experience. We don't know everything about it, about ourselves, about others, or about the world. We can't grasp it or hold it. And if we try and grasp or hold it, to quote Hakuin, who I think is the best commentator on the Heart Sutra, he says that we are digging ourselves into a hole to get at the blue sky. That's what we do when we try and grasp it and nail it down. But reality, the place that is the here of the Heart Sutra, is near at hand. We just have to find our heart and look with the eye of compassion at the truths of our experience, which are here with us in the room. And though we're in a time of pandemic, now is always the only time we can practice. That's always true. And as it happens, now is a good time. I'm not saying it's an easy time, because I myself have been affected in some very difficult ways by the consequences of the pandemic, as many of us have. But it's a good time for practice. We've been interrupted. Perhaps we've been interrupted from some of our slumbers and habits and grasping. Perhaps we've been changed, and perhaps we can learn from this. We can realise that it's okay to not be in our comfort zones in terms of practice. And we can keep aiming at the place that is the here then of the Heart Sutra with an open heart. We can find a way to sit back from the drama of our own soap operas, whilst also seeing our own trials and tribulations with compassion. We can see bubbles for bubbles and flashes in the pan as flashes in the pan. We can see change and impermanence and interconnectedness as how it is, and go under the froth into the ocean of our being to see more broadly and clearly. And that will bring energy and love and insight and perspective. So I want to end with a quote from Franz Kafka, who wasn't a bodhisattva, nor even a Buddhist. But I think he's a great writer. This little quote, it almost sounds like he's writing, it almost sounds like he's tweeting and doing an intense tweet from lockdown. But this is a very different place that Kafka is coming from. But this is what he says to us, and I think perhaps it's pertinent to us today at this particular time. And I will let that be the end of the talk. There is no need for you to leave the house. Stay at your table and listen. Don't even listen. Just wait. Don't even wait. Be completely quiet and alone. The world will offer itself to you to be unmasked. It can't do otherwise. In raptures, it will writhe before you.